Thank you, Your Honor.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Flory, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. The next case on our oral argument calendar today is Minder v. Negri. Counsel, thank you for appearing today by our online platform rather than in person. For the sake of the record, we all are in different locations today rather than at the Minnesota Judicial Center. We will be keeping an audio recording of this proceeding. So counsel, I will remind you of our usual rule that's in place still today that as you commence each leg of your argument, for the sake of our audio recording, please state your name. It helps the listeners attach arguments to arguers. And for the sake of our technology, let's just confirm that we are all seeing and hearing each other. I'm assuming you are seeing and hearing me since I see some nods. If you could, if counsel could confirm that, you can both see and hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you could make a statement, just so we can confirm that all of the judges can see and hear you, and as well as your opponent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Katie Lammers here for the appellant.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jeffrey Berg here for the respondent.
Thank you. And my colleagues on the court.
Good morning, everyone. This is Judge Flory. I can hear everyone just fine.
Good morning. I can hear everybody fine as well.
Wonderful. And for the sake of technology, I'm assuming everyone's familiar with how Zoom works in this day and age where whether we want to or not, we all have become experts in the technology. But in case you're not aware, there is a toggle opportunity in the top right-hand corner of your screen that allows you to either use a speaker view or a gallery view. And I do recommend that you use the gallery view because once you commence your argument, the clock will appear on the marshal screen most visible to you. And if you only have it in speaker view, that image will be in a very small thumbnail and you may have a difficult time keeping track of your time restrictions. With that, counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And of course, respondent will have a total of 15 minutes. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Katie Lammers, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Jai Negri. There are two main issues before the court today. First, did the district court abuse its discretion and misapply the law when it awarded respondent sole legal and sole physical custody? And did the district court abuse its discretion and misapply the law when it restricted appellant's parenting time? Your Honors, this case is about two teenage girls who lived their entire lives until February of 2017 with the appellant when they were taken from their mother's home and placed with their father, the respondent. This case is about the district court making up its mind and having the means fit the ends. When you really take a look at the entire record and facts of this case that have been totally ignored, the conclusion must be that the district court erred both in the application of the law and also abused its discretion in making the November 2019 order. The district court erred because it made no findings as to why sole legal custody was in the children's best interests. The court did not give adequate weight to the preference of these teenage girls. The court did not give adequate weight to the party's mental health. The court indisputably was mistaken as to whether appellant's therapist reviewed the court record and thus improperly dismissed her testimony. The court did not properly weigh the passage of time and intervening circumstances, including a custody order, the October 2018 order, that had occurred since the 2017 custody evaluation and the last guardian ad litem report, which was issued in 2018. The court repeatedly relied on incomplete, inaccurate misrepresentations of quotes and medical records. The court erred when it refused to find that the children's present environment with their father was endangering them emotionally. And finally, the court erred as a matter of law when it restricted appellant's parenting time. The brief lays out the facts of this case. This case has a lengthy and significant legal history. Most recently, in March of 2019, appellant brought a motion to modify custody following the elder daughter, MIN's, suicide attempt and hospitalization. Following a hearing, the district court placed temporary custody with respondent and ordered that appellant's parenting time be supervised and set the matter on for trial on the issues of appellant's motion to modify physical custody based upon endangerment, the review of the sole legal custody label pursuant to the October 2018 stipulation based upon best interest, and parenting time for each parent, as appellant had requested the majority of the parenting time and respondent requested supervised time for the appellant.
Trial. Ms. Lammers, if I could interrupt, because I know you don't have much time, mm-hmm. and I'm confident that the judges and myself have reviewed not just your brief, but also the various orders in this case. I'd like to ask a question about the standard of review that we're applying. I understand that when it comes to legal custody, we were looking at just the best interest factors. When it comes to the physical custody, because it was a modification motion, we are looking at whether the endangerment, whether in this case, I believe mother as the moving party would have proven the endangerment prong as well as the best interest factors. So my question is on that first part, when we're just looking at the best interest factors for purposes of reviewing the decision regarding legal custody.
Yes.
And you rattled through several of your arguments. Those also sound like factual disputes. The district court finds as a matter of fact that the preference stated by the children is not reliable because it's tainted by their influence from mother. Isn't that a factual finding as opposed to a decision that we would be reviewing under abuse of discretion?
So that particular instance, Your Honor, is a factual finding. So with respect to the children's preference, there was also corroborating testimony about the fact that these teenage girls wanted to live and be with their mom. They had been with their mom the entirety of their lives until there was this abrupt change. And so while that particular instance is a factual finding, the court has to make detailed findings as to how each of the statutory best interest factors actually leads to the conclusion that the court came to. So that's Minnesota Statute 518.17. So while the court makes the detailed findings, they actually have to draw a correlation as to how each of those findings results in being in the children's best interest. So
as I hear your argument, then I see it in writing, it feels to me as if you're challenging the way the court weighed different pieces of evidence, the preference of the child, the children, the mental health, the reports. And we've got a pretty large mountain of precedent that tells us on appeal, but one thing we don't do is reweigh the evidence and reassess credibility determinations unless there's some rather extraordinary basis for us to do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Citing to the Weatherly versus Weatherly case, this appellate court has reversed custody awards where the trial court has improperly weighed the evidence that's been available for both parents. One of the issues that my client brings to the court here today is when you take a
look— Let me just jump in, Ms. Landers. Are you agreeing then that that Judge Ross has properly summarized your arguments as weighing the evidence? I understand that there are also weighing of factors at play potentially, but to the extent that we were talking about those, the best interest findings that the court has made, is it correct then what Judge Ross said, that you're asking us to reweigh the evidence as the court did in Weatherly?
Yes, Your Honor, to a certain extent, because when you look at the entirety of the record, particularly things such as medical records that were quoted and stopping just short of kind of expressing the full quote, when you do look at the trial record as a whole, the weight of the evidence needs to be looked at again. And part of the reason for that is the district court relied heavily, extremely heavily. If you look at the testimony that was actually presented at the 2019 trial, the district court repeatedly went to the well of the 2017 custody evaluation. Both parties in this case asked for the court to reappoint a guardian ad litem, and the court expressly declined to do that. So we're taking evidence that was put in at 2017, and we're not giving any account for a 2-year passage of time. Every single witness that my client put on, from Joe Noble, her co-parenting therapist, to her treating therapist, to her parenting supervisor, they all corroborated the fact that my client was doing work on herself. The parenting consultant, the court-ordered neutral parenting consultant, Bonnie Westlin, also identified that my client did have the capacity to try to work with the respondent. And so by applying the 2017 custody evaluation and giving that weight to the current circumstances of 2019, there's just no correlation as to how the court could make those particular findings. For instance, in 2017, when the girls were initially placed with the respondent, everybody made a really big deal about the fact that, oh, they transitioned seamlessly and everything was going just fine. Well, fast forward to, you know, 2019, and we've got these girls both with extreme problems, self-harming. There's been a lot of testimony that goes to show that these are intelligent girls. They weren't little kids. They knew that something happened that removed them from their mother's primary care. And they've been really given no room to react or respond to that. What the district court has done has continued to lay the blame of these children's difficulty in transition at the feet of my clients. One of the most egregious things that I take issue with the district court's order, Your Honors, is the testimony from my client's therapist, the appellant's therapist, Noreen Wolani. The court was indisputably wrong about whether the appellant's therapist had reviewed the court record. Since April of 17, the appellant had been in weekly therapy, and she was making significant progress in addressing her trauma responses, her view of the domestic abuse in her past, and her view of the respondent as her co-parent, and also as a positive and necessary influence in the children's lives. Ms. Wolani's testimony placed the appellant in a positive light and demonstrated that she had worked hard over the last several years to redefine her perspective and narrative about the respondent. The court, however, dismissed all of this testimony simply by saying it didn't appear that she had reviewed the file, and thus the appellant was not being counseled effectively.
Was that the only reason? Sorry, was that the only reason that the district court discredited that or weighed that testimony less than you would have preferred? Or were there other reasons as well?
No, Your Honor. I know that the district court did some questioning of Ms. Wolani itself and wanted her to kind of place this specific pinpoint in time as to when the appellant had kind of started to change her perspective on the respondent. And Ms. Wolani kind of testified that's not how this goes. You know, it's a progression in things, and it's not, you know, this kind of switch that necessarily flips. And when I asked her about that, you know, she explained that she did see progress in the appellant. But really, when you look at the court's order, that is what he relies on. He says, well, she must not know the history, and she doesn't, you know enough to actually counsel the appellant effectively. And that directly contradicts her testimony. And I believe that the respondent even acquiesces that Ms. Wolani did review the guardian ad litem reports and the prior orders in the case. Additionally, and of grave concern, was the district court's willingness to place itself in the position of expert and dictate that DBT therapy was the most appropriate therapeutic mechanism for the appellant. The appellant had already completed DBT therapy that was recommended by the guardian ad litem earlier in the case. And in 2019, there was no professional evidence that was presented to substantiate that respondent had to redo DBT therapy. And so by the court making that recommendation, it was far beyond the court's scope of expertise. So if indeed the appellant's therapist had reviewed the court record, it would mean that my client, the appellant, was credible when she testified that she had gone to great lengths to address her side of the co-parenting dysfunction, which was also corroborated by parenting coach Joe Noble's testimony. Your Honors, we've already talked about the passage in time and weight of the evidence, but I would like to just address that a lot had changed at trial since 2017, and the court impermissibly gave too much weight on an outdated evaluation, particularly in light of what had changed. With respect to appellant meeting her burden of endangerment with the minor children, the court did make a prima facie case finding initially that appellant had met her burden, but ultimately stated that she failed to meet her burden that the children were endangered in the respondent's care. The respondent's failure to bring the children—
Ms. Lammers, let me interrupt briefly. I want to make sure I understand the burdens in this case. When it comes to the parenting time piece, my understanding is that mother was asking to change the primary residence of the children. Okay, so then mother would have the burden to prove endangerment in order to prevail on the parenting time piece. Is that right?
Yes, so she made her prima facie case and the district court correctly found that she did. And then after that, there would need to be a finding of endangerment and then also an application of the best interest factors. The court doesn't even get to those best interest factors as they might pertain to the children being placed with mother.
Correct, and I understand, I wanna move along because there's not much time. I understand that the best interest factors might have weighed differently when you're looking at parenting time as opposed to custody. And so there are, you know, maybe those neutral factors that would weigh differently if you were looking at parenting time. Well, my specific question then for you is, as a legal matter, you're agreeing that mom has the burden to prove endangerment in order to prevail on the parenting time motion, as opposed to father bearing the burden to prove endangerment.
Yes, I do.
Okay, and thank you.
Yes, I do agree with that, Your Honor. And I believe she did meet that burden. It is undisputed that both children were self-harming when they were in father's sole care and custody. The appellant really had very little parenting time with the children when the suicide attempt happened in March of 2019. So it is undisputed that both of these children were self-harming and having extreme difficulty in the care of their father. And the record is fairly clear that all of that was occurring on respondents' watch, frankly, without appellant having much impact with the children. And so when the district court's response and reaction to simply removing mom and providing 4% of supervised parenting time, which is ultimately what the district court awarded her, is simply an abuse of discretion and a misapplication of the law. And Your Honors, for these reasons, and the additional reasons listed in my brief, I respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's decision and remand for new findings. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Berg. I represent the respondent father. The caption references Richard Minder. He goes by Chad Minder throughout this proceeding. Your Honors, we respectfully request that this court sustain the trial court's decision. This was the second trial of custody and parenting time in this matter. As the court is well aware, after looking at—
Judge Ross, I would note the clock hasn't started.
Okay. Thank you for observing that. The clock needs to be adjusted.
I'm sorry for interrupting, Mr. Berg.
No problem. Thank you. I see it now. Like many family law cases, the procedural and history of a case, especially one like this involving custody and parenting time, is very complicated. I think it's important to just briefly clarify that the way this case started was a motion by the respondent for ex parte relief when the younger daughter was in the hospital for eating disorder. And there was significant issues regarding both girls and their education and whether there was some neglect by the appellant in providing for that. The trial court granted the respondent's request for ex parte relief in February of 2017. There was a hearing shortly thereafter, and the court granted temporary sole legal and sole physical custody and limited parenting time on weekends.
Mr. Berg, I'm going to interrupt you as well. I think that the judges are probably familiar with the facts and with the posture of the case and with what happened in 2017, 2018. I'd like to fast forward you, if I could, to the motion that Mother makes. And my recollection is that that was an ex parte, a temporary motion as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. That was when the second child was hospitalized for emotional issues. It's hard to parse these words. When the older child was hospitalized, it was for suicide ideation. And
before we get to that, I have another question which relates to the nature of the motions that Mother made. Again, these were ex parte temporary motions. Was there any motion for permanent custody change, or were they baked into the ex parte emergency motion?
I believe they were baked into the ex parte motion. What was even, as I prepared for trial and as I prepared for this appeal, in the motions, technically there was only a request for legal custody of the older child and joint legal custody of the older child. But the reality of this case is we needed to deal with both children.
And so you're not challenging or concerned with the district court construing that emergency motion as also pertaining to both children and pertaining to legal physical custody as well as parenting time on a permanent basis?
Absolutely. We were in favor of addressing all matters that we could to bring resolution.
My next question then would be regarding the endangerment standard and whether it's your position that it's not just the moving party would have to prove endangerment in order to obtain modification, but that we have clarified what that means and that there is a connection between the conduct of the custodial party and the danger, the substantial and actual danger that the child is experiencing. Would you agree that there has to be this connection between the conduct of the custodial party and the danger?
Yes, we would, Your Honor. So the circumstances when the district court addressed endangerment throughout the trial and the proceedings in this matter, the court really focused on the fact that number one, there wasn't any endangerment with the children being with the respondent. And I would also just quickly allude to the fact that when the district court made the prima facie case, I don't believe what the court said was that the children were endangered with their father. I think the court said the children were endangered, their physical and emotional health, and it warranted a evidentiary hearing. And an evidentiary hearing was held, and the court made significant findings that the behavior of the appellant for many years and during this proceeding continued. The trial court and the trial transcript talks a lot about the narrative of the mother and how the appellant routinely attempted to say and have her witnesses testify that the narrative had changed, but the facts remain that the narrative didn't change, that during this proceeding, the mother literally brought the child to in July of 2018, brought the child to Southview Medical Center because the child was having a panic attack, and gave that discretion to go to the hospital to the minor child. And during that process, talked about the abuse that had occurred by the father. And in fact, the hospital staff filed one of the many complaints or notices with Child Protection. And so I think the trial court's conclusion of the strong endangerment is that we have a history of the appellant very cleverly communicating messages to not only the children, to the schools, to the medical providers, to therapists, to frankly, the contacts that she is with that supported this story, and it continued the atmosphere or attitude with these young ladies about why or supported why they did not want to be with their father. The trial court concludes the order with references to not understanding the correlation and how these young ladies can make these allegations and claims of abuse when there was none. And not only did the custody evaluator conclude that there was no abuse by the father, the guardian ad litem concluded there was no abuse by the father. The court was very clear in its finding that there was no abuse that was in effect related to this case of abuse by the father. And so, you know, I think that the endangerment standard as it pertains to the or the responsibility or the burden of the appellant was clearly not satisfied as it pertained to the request to modify physical custody and the request to substantially modify the parenting time and seek a change in the primary residence. I also want to, if I have the time, Your Honor, share with you some of these thoughts regarding the therapist and the DBT therapy. It is clear that starting in 2006, when there was a CHIPS case involved in this matter, the case plan included mom going to DBT therapy, which she did not. The custody evaluator in 2017 recommended DBT therapy, and she did not. Well, she did go to therapy with Noreen Molani, and I'll reference that. And so did the guardian ad litem, and so did the psych evaluator recommend DBT therapy. And why is it that the court concluded that the DBT therapy provided by Noreen Molani was not appropriate? I think there's a number of factors. I agree when I reviewed the transcript that the district court could have made an error when it represented that that Noreen Molani had not read the court orders. She testified that she did. But what the reason I think that it was a harmless error or it was not prejudicial is that if you listen to what Noreen Molani said in her testimony, or you read the testimony, she says, number one, this was not an appropriate therapy for the appellant. The guardian ad litem interviewed Noreen Molani, and she said in so many words, Well, we did the DBT therapy to comply with the court order. And then maybe most importantly, when you look at the testimony of the appellant, she basically says, yes, I participated in DBT therapy, but it wasn't necessary. Noreen Walani didn't recommend it. And basically, I'm using the process or what I learned in there to assist me in my own therapy practice or when I'm meeting with with clients. And so when the court said or the district court concluded that it was not appropriate for the appellant to have DBT therapy with Noreen Walani, it wasn't just because she hadn't read, or if she had read the reports, there's a lot more to that. Noreen Walani is not the what appears to be the appropriate person, or the judge did not have confidence in her to provide the level of therapy that was deemed appropriate. There's also was reference briefly to the 25% presumption of the parenting time. And I would draw to the court's attention that again, the 25% presumption is rebuttable. And the Hagen and Shermer's versus Shermer's case clarifies that if the child is endangered, the presumption is not necessarily appropriate. And further, I think the Hagen versus Shermer's case clarifies that if it's not raised in the trial, and I do not believe, I reviewed the arguments and the memorandum that was submitted by appellant's counsel, and the 25% presumption was not argued. Therefore, I do not believe that the district court was required under the case law to expressly respond to that, or it wasn't error, was not error to not expressly provide for that.
Can I ask a question about that, Mr. Berg?
Sure.
Because you have a stipulation, and my recollection is that the stipulation has two phases, and the party's phase one agreement is not that different from what the district court ends up ordering in 2019.
I think what...
Well, let me put it this way. Even under phase two, under the stipulation, mom's parenting time is well below 25%.
Correct. And I think
that... Is there any authority for the proposition that when you have one order at one point in time with less than 25%, that every other subsequent modification motion that the party who is requesting that the other parent have less than 25% overcome some burden? Is there any authority for that? Or is it once you've made that decision, the modification motions are subject to the modification standard?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question respectfully. I believe that from my practice, if the party stipulated to a less than 25% parenting time schedule in the order, which was the October order, and we were going to review that order regarding parenting time, and that was sort of enveloped in all of the legal proceedings in this matter. I don't know that it is required that there be a 25% or they're locked into a less than 25% parenting time schedule. I believe that in this case, the in order to get to what the appellant was looking for in basically changing the primary residence, not only was the best interest standard to be reviewed, but she would need to get to the level of endangerment. And the court was very clear in the 160 some findings that focused on the factors of the best interest standard that the appellant did not establish endangerment, and in fact continued with the prior determination that in fact the girls were endangered if there wasn't limitations regarding mom's custody and parenting time in this matter.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the 25% presumption and the restriction of
parent. Again, just for the sake of our audio recording, we can see you and your name, but those listening to your argument won't be able to. If you could just state your name for the sake of the record, please.
Thank you for the reminder, Your Honor. Katie Lammers again on behalf of the appellant. With respect to the restriction of parenting time, Judge Bryan, I believe where you are going with this is the Dahl case kind of lays out a baseline for what we take a look at as far as whether parenting time constitutes a reduction or a restriction. And the court does need to make findings. It can't restrict a parent's parenting time unless it makes findings that parenting time is likely to endanger the child's physical or emotional health or impair the child's well-being. So while we had started in the stipulation building towards some unsupervised parenting time, at one point in time, the appellant had been the primary caregiver of these children. And obviously throughout the passage of time that had been whittled away and reduced, but just because she had started at this certain point did not mean that the court still didn't need to make the requisite findings that 4% of parenting time was somehow justified for a parent who had previously been the child's primary caregivers. So I would like to just reiterate.
Isn't that the requirement at the time of the stipulation in 2018, the October order? At that point in time, mom's parenting time is well below 25% under either the two phases. So at that point, if the court failed to make those findings, potentially that could have been some basis for a challenge, but it was a stipulation. So I thought you had conceded in your opening argument that it's mom who bears the burden to show endangerment when it comes to modifying parenting time, given the change in primary residence, not dad's burden to show endangerment under the 25%, the presumption in the 25% statute.
To clarify my position on that, Your Honor, I do concede that in order to change custody, my client was asking for a change of custody, that she would need to prove endangerment. And
I'm specifically talking about parenting time and the case law that requires the custody modification standard to be applied to parenting time modification motions when there's a change in the primary residence or a substantial restriction.
Yes. So if you're talking about, and I think you are, a substantial change of custody that would change the child's primary residence, whether my client had to show endangerment on that, even if we are talking about that instead of best interest, she still has met that endangerment. I mean, this court has issued multiple decisions that show has led us to believe and know that endangerment can be emotional endangerment. And, you know, while there are issues with these children and conflicting information about whether they had been actually abused in dad's home, the reality of the situation is these are not babies, they're teenagers. They know that they were removed from mom's home. They have some idea that that came about through a court process that they had little or no control over. And they are angry and they did not have a voice. There was not a guardian that was reappointed. Of grave concern to my client was that the respondent did not appropriately bring the children to therapy. It's shocking that there was no therapist for these children who testified at this 2019 trial after the child tried to commit suicide and hospitalized. to not have mental health testimony on behalf of these children is shocking. And the reason why that happened, it's not because nobody called them, it's because they didn't have sufficient therapeutic relationships with therapists at that time. So the children simply had no voice in this case. And my client was subsequently awarded 4% of supervised parenting time. And the court simply did not draw appropriate correlations as to why that was in the children's best interest. So even if she did have to meet the endangerment standard, it is undisputed that the children were emotionally endangered and self-harming in the care of dad. And whether we don't have to speculate as to why that is, because the fact is they are endangered. They were endangered in dad's care.
So you disagree with the cases that would say that there has to be a connection between the conduct of the custodial parent and the danger that the child is facing?
Yes, because the children's danger can be emotional, and that may come about overtly or covertly. But the fact of the matter is, when children are self-harming and they are suffering from, you know, things such as exacerbated eating disorders, maybe that's not specifically because dad is, you know, spanking them at home or, you know, not providing you know, food or something like that. But the fact of the matter is they're still endangered in the home, whether it was an overt act by the respondent or that particular parent or not. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Lambers and Mr. Berg, for your written argument and for your oral presentation today. We do appreciate the quality of your argument and especially for appearing virtually through this platform. The case is submitted. We have taken it under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
And given that this is the last case on our oral calendar for today, we are in recess.